Greetings and welcome to another fine afternoon at CSIS. I'm sorry this isn't a more topical discussion today. John Lipsky is here, the first deputy managing director of the IMF. His topic is the global economy and financial turmoil, and this he came up with the title some time ago. He may want to revise the phrase turmoil to something a little bit more pejorative, but we'll leave that to him. This is a very distinguished speaker, and we're really happy to have him here at CSIS. He's been in his current position for about 2 years, but before that has a long and very distinguished career at a group of banks in particular that are still standing. He was the vice chairman at J.P. Morgan Investment Bank, and before that was the chief economist at J.P., at Chase, Salomon, and I think that covers the waterfront. He started before that. He was before he left for Salomon in 1984. He was at the IMF for 10 years, where he helped manage the funds exchange rate surveillance procedure and analyze developments in international capital markets. So this is somebody that has been done it, as we say, and we're very delighted to have him. Graduate of Wesleyan up north with an MA and a PhD in economics from a little place called Stanford. Please join me in welcoming John Lipsky.
Thanks very much, Charles, for that nice welcome. And I guess if I can call this turmoil, then you can call me distinguished. We won't. But thanks for the opportunity to join you here today. Obviously, the financial market developments over the past few days really have been dramatic. They've included the bankruptcy of a major U.S. investment bank, the acquisition of another by a large commercial bank, federal government's intervention to shore up the GSEs, followed by the Federal Reserve's provision of a massive emergency loan to stave off the disorderly bankruptcy of the world's largest insurance firm. These are only the latest searing manifestations of a financial crisis that has expanded rather suddenly to historic proportions. Now, there is now almost universal consensus that the global economy is set to weaken, with the debate shifting from whether emerging economies would decouple from the advanced economies to whether the slowdown will be shallow and somewhat protracted or deep and very long. While the events of the past week underscore the seriousness of the situation, my message today is straightforward. This storm can be weathered without a damaging global recession, but attaining such an outcome will require clear and coherent policy responses from public authorities and institutions around the world, together with a restoration of private market functionality and an end to the investors' spiraling crisis of confidence. It's obvious that the challenges at hand are daunting. The confluence we see before us is without historic precedence. This includes three shocks to commodity prices, to housing markets, and to the financial sector. Together, they represent the principal source of the sharp strains that are sweeping across financial markets. The contours of the challenge are shifting, however, with energy and commodity prices well down from their earlier all-time highs. Inflation pressures should begin to recede in most advanced economies, opening the prospect for a gradual restoration of consumers' purchasing power. At least in the battered U.S. housing market, the prospect is emerging of an eventual bottoming out in the steep drop in activity, and we expect prices to begin to stabilize in the course of the coming year. Now, according to IMF analysis, the most likely outcome is that the financial turmoil still underway in many advanced economy markets will not by itself prevent a gradual recovery in economic activity in 2009. Nonetheless, the turmoil is one reason why we expect the recovery to be only gradual. And at the same time, the moderate growth we expect will not be sufficiently powerful to quickly end the deleveraging and sector shrinkage afflicting financial institutions in many key markets. Moreover, the dangers created by the financial crisis still represent the principal risk to near-term growth prospects. Now, there's no doubt about the ability of flexible market economies to rebound from adverse shocks. Moreover, non-financial corporate sectors in many key economies, in particular in the United States, have entered this period of financial turbulence in a relatively strong position of high profits and profit margins, solid productivity gains, and low leverage. Nonetheless, a decisive public policy response to the current challenges also represents a necessary element for resisting the potentially significant damage from the financial turmoil. Now, a bit more than 6 months ago, I spoke about the various macroeconomic, financial, and crisis management policies that were available to policymakers, urging them to think the unthinkable. The unprecedented policy responses of the past few days, principally but not exclusively in the United States, have demonstrated that monetary and fiscal authorities in advanced economies have been willing to implement innovative and unorthodox measures when they appear to be warranted. Some of the options that I outlined in those earlier remarks, most notably use of the public balance sheet to support specific institutions and markets, have been exercised. However, the essentially reactive and inevitably case-specific nature of many of these measures raises the question whether broader and more proactive approaches have become warranted. Now, outside the United States and looking beyond the market turbulence that has followed in the wake of last weekend's events, there's no doubt that the macroeconomic picture is evolving in a worrisome direction. Advanced economies that appeared resilient earlier on are now faltering. As housing markets in the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Spain turn down, concerns about feedback to the financial sector are mounting. Some key mortgage lenders in the United Kingdom are facing increased losses, and policymakers there have helped this week to arrange the sale of the country's fifth largest bank. In the emerging economies, the balance of risk in many countries is shifting as inflation risks have begun to recede and downside risks to growth have intensified. Now, the IMF's flagship analysis of global economic and financial developments, the World Economic Outlook, and the Global Financial Stability Report will soon be released to the public, and they will provide our full analysis of current conditions and challenges. In anticipation of those documents' release, I'll provide today the fund's broad take on the current state of the global economy. I'll explain in a bit more detail why we are cautiously optimistic about the underlying resilience of the global economy, and I'll describe the key policy options that will be needed to be considered, at least to be considered, in order to stave off the very real risk to the global outlook. I'll begin with the current situation. First of all, economic performance is becoming bifurcated. Advanced and emerging economies are moving in the same direction, that is, growth everywhere is slowing, decisively ending any hopes of a growth decoupling, but they are facing two different sorts of problems. Nearing the end of the year's third quarter, most advanced economies are either virtually stagnant or on the verge of recession, while underlying inflation risks are becoming increasingly well contained. The growth slowdown that originated in the United States has spread, as evidenced by the decline in activity in the second quarter in both the euro area and Japan. Advanced economies in general face a spell of growth very well below potential, very far below potential, as they grapple with the ongoing strains of from the financial crisis that began a year ago, as well as the lingering effects of high oil prices and weaker external demand. For these economies, headline inflation reached 4.5% in July, a rate not seen since the early 1990s. This acceleration was driven mainly by energy and commodity price increases. At the same time, however, underlying inflation has remained subdued, hovering around 2%. We expect headline inflation to moderate significantly in the advanced economies, reflecting the impact of retreating energy and commodity prices and the emergence of increasing margins of unused capacity in these economies. As for emerging economies, their aggregate growth rates continue to diverge but not decouple from the advanced economies. After all, growth rates in the advanced economies in the aggregate are slowing about 2% this year. And in emerging economies, growth in the aggregate is slowing by about 2 to 2.5%. But the difference is from a much higher rate. Put simply, emerging economies cannot defy gravity in an increasingly multipolar world. Still, they can exhibit some important degrees of resistance. Activity gains in these economies is decelerating, as I noted, but growth still is expected to remain near trend, at least in the emerging economies. Growth has moderated in these economies from an annual pace of about 8.5% in the middle quarters of 2007 to 7.25% in the past three quarters. This largely reflects slowing export growth as a result of weaker demand from advanced economies. More recently, there are signs that capital is beginning to flow out of many emerging economies, reflecting both declining risk appetite and moderating growth prospects. And in response, many of these countries have experienced sharp exchange rate depreciations. In some cases, this is a welcome development, as previous appreciation pressures associated with capital inflows was leading to exchange rate overshooting. However, these new outflows also are creating risk for these economies that warrant close attention. Now, the implication of these developments is that the balance of risks is shifting for many emerging economies. To be clear, inflation is still a key problem for some of the emerging economies, and tighter policies are still required in some cases so as to ensure that the hard-won gains in monetary policy credibility are not eroded. But for many other emerging economies, downside risks to growth are increasing, while risks to inflation appear more subdued. As the balance of risk shifts, so should policymakers' responses. Against this backdrop, our three main challenges, high commodity prices, the housing downturn in the United States and some other advanced economies, and the financial turmoil still remain. On their own, any of these three shocks could be dealt with through standard policies. However, the interplay of the three shocks has made policymaking much more difficult, as I will discuss shortly. But before doing so, I'd like to elaborate on how each of these shocks appear to be evolving. First, the energy and commodity price shock has introduced a serious constraint on the ability of policymakers to conduct countercyclical monetary policy, particularly in the advanced economies. The good news from this perspective is that this shock appears to be unwinding, at least to some degree. And in particular, oil prices, as you all know, have fallen sharply in recent weeks. In our view, both the run-up in prices earlier in the summer and the subsequent decline in prices primarily reflect shifts in fundamental, especially changes in expected demand and supply trends. With both supply and short-term demand for oil highly inelastic, small shifts in the supply-demand balance can lead to large price swings in cash markets. So with demand still running strong early in the summer and with perceived margins of excess capacity in this industry very tight or even non-existent, prices rose dramatically. And more recently, as oil demand has declined and supply has increased, prices have retreated from earlier highs. Now, if these trends are sustained, that is, looking beyond the short-term disturbances created by the U.S. hurricane season and by financial uncertainties, this would help create new space for countercyclical monetary and, in some cases, budgetary policies. So here we're gaining some flexibility. Second, the housing downturn. The epicenter of the slowdown in the United States is still unfolding. House prices on a national basis continue to fall, and inventories of unsold homes remains high. Now, as prices fall, the collateral value of housing is declining, which is squeezing already limited access to credit. Despite this collateral effect, consumption has held up better than might have been expected, in part because the moderate drop in total employment has not prevented a modest ongoing gain in disposable income, including the impact of the income tax rebates that were distributed at the end of the second quarter. As I'll discuss shortly, we see some prospective light at the end of the U.S. housing tunnel in the course of 2009. And at the same time, house price declines and sharp drops in residential construction also are underway in some economies outside the United States. This is creating challenges for the authorities, as these weakening trends could still have some way to go before they're likely to be halted and eventually reversed. Well, finally, the strains in financial markets have intensified recently, more than a year after the turmoil first erupted, and we do not expect the turbulence to fully subside for some time to come. Stepping back from the events of the past week, the broader issue facing the financial sector is that many sectors facing the prospect of a much reduced revenue stream compared to both recent experience and earlier expectations, together with a prospective shortage of capital if asset price declines continue, forcing new write-offs. For sure, banks in the United States and Europe have raised substantial amounts of capital in the past year, but these infusions are still some $150 billion less than the write-downs, and further capital raising will become much more expensive, if not impossible. Given the scale of the financial distress, a protracted process of deleveraging and restructuring is unavoidable. In short, it has become obvious that the financial sector in the United States and elsewhere is in the midst of a historic reordering that will alter market and institutional structures. At this point, anticipating the specific outcome is highly speculative, but a return to rapid credit growth appears to be a long way off. Given these challenges, one could reasonably expect that we would be pessimistic about the global outlook and the scope for recovery. For sure, the further tightening of financial conditions in light of recent events will have some negative implications for global economic activity, not least because it is likely to diminish the scope for a rapid recovery of credit creation. However, several factors provide a degree of reassurance that a severe downturn can be avoided. First, as I noted earlier, oil prices have come down sharply. This should reverse a significant portion of the adverse terms of trade effects arising from the more than 60% increase in oil prices during 2008 and the erosion in purchasing power and real wages being felt by the most advanced economies. In the United States, if oil prices just remain at their current levels, the implied boost to real disposable income will rival the value of the income tax rebates. Indeed, in our projection, we expect a modest rebound in consumption in both the United States and the euro area over the course of 2009. Second, it is plausible to anticipate that the U.S. housing market will find a bottom in the coming year. Already, the inventory overhang is diminishing, while affordability measures are returning to levels that appear much more consistent with past experience. The recent U.S. Treasury support for the GSEs was intended to allow these agencies to continue expanding their balance sheets through 2009, while direct Treasury purchases of the GSEs' mortgage securities should help to keep mortgage costs down. As a consequence, we expect residential investment to find a floor, and this will reduce the considerable drag amounting to at least 0.75% of GDP over the past couple of years of the housing sector on economic activity. At the same time, the eventual stabilization of house prices should help to restrain mortgage-related losses and contribute to restoring financial institutions to health. And third, while financial conditions have tightened in both the United States and Europe, it does not mean that an economic recovery is thereby excluded. In the United States, for example, corporate finances in general remain relatively healthy. Productivity gains have helped to sustain profits. Time-limited investment tax credits will encourage corporate capital expenditures in the coming months. In fact, this seems to have been forgotten that one of the two elements of the tax stimulus measures introduced this year in the United States included individual income tax rebates, but also an accelerated investment tax credit for businesses, time stamp for this year. Whereas the expected magnitude of the tax rebates, the individual rebates, were about $140 billion, the expected value of the investment tax credits are potentially as high as $65 billion, and those were likely to be felt towards the end of this year. Moreover, recent IMF analysis suggests that a slowdown in credit intermediation does not necessarily imply economic or impede economic recovery. And finally, relatively robust emerging market growth, even though albeit slower than previously, is being led by strong domestic demand in several of these economies, and we've already seen how that's helped to boost U.S. exports. Going forward, we expect net exports to continue to support growth in the United States, albeit not at the really rapid pace of the past quarter, as the effects of the earlier declines in the value of the dollar are still going to take hold with a lag. Of course, the dollar has strengthened in recent months. Nonetheless, the fund analysis indicates that the U.S. currency is still somewhat on the strong side relative to medium-term fundamentals. At the same time, the limited adjustment of currencies in several economies with pegged exchange rate regimes and large current account surpluses has not been adequately supportive of global adjustment while preserving growth. In other words, there's still further adjustment that would be justified and helpful in global currency markets. But taken together and against this background, we project global growth to come in around 4% in 2008 and something just under 4% in 2009, but on an annual average basis. The dynamics are portrayed much more clearly when growth rates are examined on a fourth quarter over fourth quarter basis. Using this metric, global growth would slow from 4.75% in 2007 to near 3% in 2008 before recovering to around 4% in 2009. Well, the challenges facing the global economy and financial system are clear, and downside risks to the outlook have increased notably. The overarching risk revolves around the feedback loop between continuing strains in financial markets and slowing economic activity. Despite aggressive policy actions aimed at alleviating liquidity strains and preventing systemic events, markets remain under severe stress, as we all know. There is a clear risk that financial conditions could deteriorate further, and more aggressive attempts by financial institutions to deleverage balance sheets could imply severe problems with credit availability. There is also a risk that emerging market economies that have so far been relatively insulated from the financial turmoil could be subjected to large reversals of capital flows with serious implications for economic activity. But the critical issue is how we deal with these challenges and risks. As a result, the remainder of my remarks will focus on the policies to address the challenges that I've just outlined. Let me emphasize, however, that the confluence of shocks have made policymaking more difficult, and resolving the current turmoil on a durable basis will require creative solutions across a range of policy instruments. Naturally, monetary and budget policies are critical, but these provide only a first and second line of defense against the deleterious impact of a financial crisis. The use of public funds to safeguard the financial system that we have labeled the third line of defense may become imperative. And it's appropriate that this option be considered in a broad, coherent, and proactive manner. The first line of defense lies with monetary authorities, both in terms of liquidity provision to the financial sector and in setting policy interest rates. Monetary policy can play a critical role in helping individual economies find their footing, but the scope for policy easing ultimately will depend on each country's cyclical position. In advanced economies, we expect the slowdown in activity to help contain inflation going forward, as I've explained. Weakening domestic demand, increasing output gaps, and sluggish labor markets should limit pressures on underlying inflation. Moreover, the recent sharp decline in oil prices should help alleviate short-term pressure on headline inflation. Hence, we see monetary policy as broadly appropriate at this time across most advanced economies. Outside the United States, given the downside risk to growth and the ongoing strains of the financial crisis, there could be scope to lower rates in the euro area and the United Kingdom if activity slows and inflation moderates, as we expect. In many emerging economies, with the shifting balance of risk between inflation and growth, there is greater scope for countries with moderating inflation and policy credibility to take a wait-and-see approach. That said, inflation risk still remains serious in countries where growth remains strong and where, given lags in pass-through, food and energy price increases, in fact, are still in the pipeline despite the declines in world market prices. for these countries, monetary policy should still have a tightening bias. Now, fiscal policy, the second line of defense, has played a role in the United States already, and automatic stabilizers are appropriately providing support as growth slows in other advanced economies. In many emerging economies, budgetary policy will have to play a supportive role to monetary policy in helping to bring down inflation. And across the advanced economies, we find that fiscal policy is broadly appropriate, but room for maneuver is limited, given the need for medium-term fiscal consolidation in many of these countries. However, support for the financial sector inevitably will involve budgetary costs that must be taken into account in considering policy alternatives. And in emerging economies where inflation remains a problem, fiscal policy should play a more supportive role in restraining demand growth and easing inflation pressures. And in particular, greater restraint on spending growth would be helpful as a complement to monetary policy. So in these areas, the outlook is somewhat more complicated and has to be viewed on a case-by-case basis. But direct intervention to support financial system, that's the third line defense that I've talked about, has and must be considered so long as there are systemic risks to the financial system. And we must keep in mind that although the situation is far from ideal, there are also a variety of other policy options that can be used, including further direct support to housing markets. In this regard, the fund welcomed the recent actions by the U.S. authorities to support Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. These actions required a significant step and a key lesson from past financial crises, notably in Japan and Scandinavia, is that direct public intervention should be of a large scale, as piecemeal efforts of this nature often are not effective. In other words, if these measures are justified, they should be done decisively. The measures taken, that have been taken, should bolster the GSE's balance sheets and stabilize the funding of mortgages. They should also substantially reduce downside risks to the U.S. growth outlook related to shortages of housing finance, although by themselves they are unlikely to turn around the U.S. housing market. Over the longer term, a deep restructuring of these GSEs remains essential to restore market discipline, minimize fiscal costs, and limit systemic risks in the future. Ultimately, the conflict of private ownership and public policy objectives within the GSE's former business model must be resolved. Now, even after the dramatic events of the past week, it would not be surprising if some additional financial institutions will not survive in their present form. Nor will market structures or instruments remain unaltered. In fact, it seems clear that the overall size of the financial sector will shrink in many markets. There is no inevitability to any overexpanding sector, at least not in relative terms. In these circumstances, the key is to strike the right balance between limiting moral hazard and safeguarding the financial system's effectiveness. This task is by no means an easy one, but the consequence, either in the short run or longer term, would be severe if the pendulum swings too far in either direction. So, to be clear, this is what makes this a particularly difficult moment to gauge adequate policy. It's clear that the financial sector in the U.S. and elsewhere has become overscaled and inevitably is going to shrink. Against that is the requirement for providing adequate liquidity and avoiding systemic risks on the other hand. So liquidity, it's hard enough to discern liquidity issues from solvency issues. But since we know that the sector is going to shrink, solvency issues doesn't mean the success and the sustaining of every individual institution and company. There will be shrinkage. What has to be avoided is systemic failure. Notwithstanding the recent use of innovative and unconventional measures, more may be needed. The implication is that a more systematic approach may be needed to deal with such basic issues as the disposition of distressed assets, the degree of protection offered to depositors, and the scale and scope of liquidity support that is offered to institutions and markets. Moreover, the fact of globalized financial markets means that policy interventions need to be globally coherent and consistent in order to be effective. Although I'm cautiously optimistic that the global economy will continue to be resilient in the face of significant headwinds, this does not imply that the policy challenges and trade-offs are not daunting. At the IMF, we stand ready to assist our members in confronting these exceptional challenges, in understanding the critical policy trade-offs, and in navigating successfully through the turbulent waters ahead. Thank you very much for your attention.
Dr. Lipsky has graciously agreed to Why are you a doctor? Yeah, graciously agreed to answer some questions, and but maybe I can start out and then turn it over to you. I was struck in particular by your last comments about essentially getting it right when you get into policy interventions, and I wonder if you can. Shed some light. I mean, given the interventions over the past not just week but before that, how does one analyze in real time whether an institution's failure presents systemic challenges to the financial system, and what are the criteria that one should use?
Well, it's a very good question, and I would say certainly it has the character of an art, not a science. It's especially when we're dealing with the growth of substantial amounts of financial innovation, and that the relative role of specific firms and sectors have been associated with these innovations. Inevitably, any financial market innovation of consequence ultimately faces a market test. And the fact is that not all innovations will pass that market test, nor should they be expected to, nor should that be that such a failure be considered a systemic failure. Not every financial innovation deserves to survive. And in the current context, after a boom period, not every financial institution can be expected to survive. Thus, judging the, as you put it, in real time, what is systemic and what is not, inevitably involves judgment. What I was suggesting in my remarks is that we've been through a very rapid period of very dramatic challenges that have created the need for exceptionally high-speed judgments in this regard. And what I was suggesting is this is probably a moment in which we should attempt to take a step back a bit and think broadly about what kinds of intervention might be needed and justified, and attempt to look at this in a somewhat more coherent and more proactive way, rather than continue in the, and I'm not ascribing blame in any way. We have been confronted with high-speed developments that required very quick judgments. But again, it's also clear that this has to be done in a coherent, decisive, an internationally coherent and decisive form. And hopefully, we will have enough breathing space with the after the current round of actions for dealing with that kind of a question in a more broad-based and proactive manner.
Let me follow up just really quickly, and then I'll turn it over. You mentioned you didn't want to ascribe blame, but we're in Washington. It's a political season. The blame is going fast and furious. Maybe it's greed. Maybe it's a lack of adequate regulatory framework. Maybe it's a failure of the human condition. Who knows? What do you think going forward, long term, do you see as either a legislative need or a legislative, whether we like it or not, imperative?
For sure, we have as and one of the active members of the Financial Stability Forum's working group participated in the development of a series of reforms, regulatory reforms, that we thought were needed and justified. And we have presented, in fact, our own report in this regard, and you can read our Global Financial Stability Report. There are some lessons, a whole series of very specific lessons that we have drawn about regulatory issues. There are other issues involved as well that I think are worth thinking about. In much of the discussion of the misfunctioning of markets over the past couple of years, it's very sobering to contemplate a critical aspect of market discipline that quite demonstrably has failed, and to think about why that has happened. What I'm thinking about specifically, we've heard a lot about originators or intermediaries' failure to exercise due diligence. We've heard a lot about the failures of rating agencies or perhaps rating agencies' actions to be misunderstood. But it has been self-evident since the process that we would call securitization developed that one of the structural implications of securitization was that the ultimate responsibility for credit analysis devolved to the end investor. And in fact, in my previous life in the private sector, one of the very clearly one of our strategies was or a basic approach revolved around that insight, namely that investors were going to bear the ultimate responsibility for asset assessment, and therefore research became developing tools to provide to clients, to investors, to help them improve their credit abilities at credit analysis. And yet we've seen repeated failure of institutional investors to exercise due diligence. And we've seen striking examples of professional investors investing in instruments they clearly did not understand mm-hmm. on the basis of the recommendation of third parties. Mm-hmm. Now, when thinking about what is the cure for that, we need to think in a penetrating way whether the market forces and market discipline will, albeit it's at an unexpectedly high price, perform the needed adjustments, or whether some regulatory or other public intervention is needed to prevent that reoccurrence of those kind of flaws. I don't quite have the way I presented it, I'm not sure of the answer. I tend to think that market discipline will be more effective mm-hmm. than is often expected in this regard. But this is, to me, one of the critical failures. After all, it's easy to say, for example, why did mortgage originators make these silly mortgages? From my point of view, the real question is who gave them the money to fund those? What were they thinking? Those were professional investors with professional, by and large, with professional responsibilities. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Just up front here.
Yeah.
Can you stand and identify yourself? We'll bring a mic over. So.
Cesar Munoz with FNU Service. Question on this issue of what you suggested, a more systemic way to deal with these troubles. I mean, are you referring to this idea of having government agency to buy bad loans, like it was the case in the 80s. And if I may ask a second question on Latin America, which seemed to have been sort of insulated of problems here. I mean, is this latest, the latest developments are going to change that? Is the region going to be impacted? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. First, are we talking, was I referring to potential use of the public balance sheet to acquire bad assets?
Or a government agency created
or,
to,
yes,
to buy.
Yes, yes. Certainly, this is one of the options that needs to be considered in a coherent way. Separation of bad assets. Now, of course, this, as I suggested, that has been tried in the past, and the lessons of the past that if that's to be done, it should be done in a decisive and broad-based way, and that piecemeal approaches tend not to be successful. So this is a serious issue. It needs to be considered. Needs to be considered in a broad and coherent framework. But I wasn't referring to just that. As I said, also the scope and scale of liquidity provision, the amount and form of depositor protection, and other similar issues are also worth considering on a proactive and at least a globally coherent basis. Oh, sorry. And in Latin America, of course, the Latin American performance on average economic performance has been improving over the past few years. Much of that, of course, has been boosted by favorable terms of trade developments. And as a result, the latest weakening in commodity prices will reduce that, putting a greater premium on good policies and good economic institutions and structures. As a result, this is an area that will, where the authorities will need to watch their continued terms of access to international capital markets and pay close attention to the adequacy of their domestic policies.
Thank you very much, sir. Ahu Özyurt from CNN Türk and Milliyet. Some of the emerging market banks have used syndication credits to some of the institutions that do not exist at this moment. Would you have any suggestion to those banks in those countries what cautionary steps they should take? And do you believe that at the end of the day, if there is an outflux of hot currency from these emerging market countries, should the central banks take the option of raising the interest rates?
Well, thank you. It's a very good question. I couldn't give a blanket answer because the specifics differ in each country. But the for sure, we are watching closely the terms of access of to international markets, especially of those emerging market countries that have depended on large-scale capital inflows to finance current account deficits. That even when in a context of ample availability of international credit, the policies seem appropriate and adequate. The change in circumstances may justify, again, I don't want to say blanket in a blanket way, but may justify a rather thorough reexamination of their policies, including of monetary policy.
Sharon from American University. My question is related to the prior question. Would you like to give some comments on the bursting of asset bubble in the emerging markets, especially in the context of the deterioration condition in financial market in America? And how much would you think that the banking system has exposure to real estate, for instance, and the spark market in these emerging markets, and the what is the possibility of its country experiencing financial crisis? Thank you.
Thank you. Again, a good question. One, it's impossible to give a broad one-size-fits-all answer because there are many, many differing circumstances, just as, for example, many emerging countries' economies benefited in many ways from the recent terms of trade shifts and may be suffering. Others may be benefiting from the opposite changes. But here again, I think the basic point is that so far, emerging markets have been relatively unaffected by the financial market turmoil, in part because in the aggregate those economies have been capital exporters. They've been running current account surpluses. Nonetheless, the combination of shift in terms of trade and shifts in capital markets could have an impact on both their economic outlook on asset prices and the situation of their financial institutions. So we at the fund are watching these trends closely, discussing with our emerging market members the unfolding events, and trying to anticipate where problems could or might arise so that we can avoid a situation in which the difficulties in the financial sector and in economies essentially centered in the advanced economies would have a significant knock-on effect in emerging markets in general.
Thank you. My name is Xiaomi, and I'm working for a Chinese business newspaper. It's called 21st Century Business Herald. And follow-up to the question about Asian market capital, can you be specific about the near future in China? In the near future, how would the capital outflow be? Also, the next question is: since you know better than us about how much money does the Federal Reserve have, so how much more bailout? How much more bailouts can they afford, and how can they afford it?
Good questions. I'm going to take the second one first. In broad terms, central banks have the responsibility to maintain liquidity and the functioning of the financial system. What you might call bailouts, or we might call this our third line of defense, and you might more neutrally call them rescue packages, but how about the use of public funds directly in support of financial institutions, is a fiscal function, is a government function, and is not primarily a central bank function. As a matter of course, to leave such actions to the central bank makes monetary management more difficult and clouds the clarity of the balance sheet of the central bank. So if we have the fund have a message, it's those are budgetary functions that are best left for budgetary methods. Nonetheless, if the central bank is the one to act, there should be some relationship with the federal budget, in the case of the U.S. and the Fed, as you ask, that would clarify that the source of the funding for such operations. In other words, under an ideal situation, your question would not be relevant because it would not be an issue of should the Fed be printing money. The question is how much fiscal involvement will there be in support of the financial institutions. And with regard to China, let's take a step back and look at the big picture. China's been a tremendously rapidly growing economy, making great strides in per capita income and other measures that have been very heartening. At the same time, as the Chinese authorities have recognized that growth has been centered to a large extent on the growth of net exports and has resulted in very large current account surpluses and a huge buildup of external assets. The Chinese authorities' policies, as elaborated, in the IMF's multilateral consultations on global imbalances conducted in 2006-2007 that culminated in April 2007 with a set of statements of policies among the five participant authorities, including the United States, the Euro area, Japan, Saudi Arabia, and China. The goal was to develop a set of policies for these individual economies that were perceived by the participants as both in their own interest and consistent with the dual goals of sustaining global growth and reducing imbalances, and thus reducing inflation pressures, and thus making the favorable results of the early part of this decade likely to be sustained. The conclusion was a very clear one, and that was to preserve success, everything had to change. And inevitably, in the United States, it was seen clearly that this basic source of growth was going to have to shift away from the reliance on outsized growth in domestic demand towards stronger growth of business investment and net exports. And in surplus economies like China, rapidly growing surplus economies like China, the reverse was going to be the case. Namely, growth was source of growth in relative terms needed to shift away from growth in net exports towards growth in domestic demand that would tend to produce a reduction in current account surplus and hence a reduction in capital outflows. Those were all seen as desirable and inevitable. That I'm belaboring this point, if you will, or elaborating, perhaps better put, because I want to suggest that in broad terms, the developments in the U.S. economy have been in line with those insights. It didn't take. It was only reasonable, to put it better. It was only reasonable and inevitable that the U.S. housing sector was going to slow. It was only reasonable and inevitable that consumption growth in the U.S. would not persistently outstrip the growth of the economy. It was desirable and inevitable that if growth rate is sustained, it would be result in a shift towards net exports. All of that has happened. The goal of the multilateral consultations was that these needed international adjustments would take place in a context of full employment and potential and in solid growth with low inflation. And I would maintain that the failure on the part of policymakers to implement the policies that they themselves indicated that would be the basis for success with adequate vigor is one of the reasons we are now confronted with a situation of financial strain, inflationary pressures, and yet subpar growth in the global economy. And hopefully the balancing policies that were foreseen as needed in those consultations will be implemented in the future and produce the results, among others, for China that are desired and needed and would be, as I said, viewed even by the participants as both beneficial individually and beneficial for the global economy. But now we have to deal with the added strains of these of both low growth and the financial turbulence, and that is runs the risk of getting us off track. I hope everywhere that danger will be avoided. Sorry for the second speech, but that was important.
I'm desperate to ask a follow-up question about the impact of the downturn in China's markets on consumer confidence and what that does to demand consumption, but I won't. I won't abuse. We've got time for one more question, and there's this very patient gentleman here who I know would like to ask a question.
Dan Newman with Inside U.S. Trade. Related to your last answer, actually, there's been some rumors today, additional rumors today, that China's sovereign wealth fund, the China Investment Corporation, was looking to make certain investments in the U.S. financial sector, including in Morgan Stanley. And I'm wondering if the prospect of a perceived politicized policy response from the U.S., including the CFIUS process as well as the U.S. Congress, might stop some part of the what you described as the internationally coherent response to the U.S. financial sector downturn?
That's a very good question, and I'm glad you brought up the issue of the sovereign wealth funds. As you may be aware, the IMF has been engaged over the last number of months with a set of 38 wealth funds, sovereign wealth funds, coming from 26 of our member countries, in working together in the International Working Group, the IWG, of the sovereign wealth funds, that most recently met 2 weeks ago in Santiago, Chile, and reached a preliminary agreement on what they're calling the generally accepted principles and practices of sovereign wealth funds, or we're calling for short the Santiago principles. And those principles will be presented. They have not yet been made public, although they've been described as covering governance, covering internal organization, and governing transparency, that will be presented to the membership of the IMF at the annual meetings in a few weeks' time. In addition, the wealth funds agreed to an implementing procedure that will be specified, that they will drive themselves, and that will be specified in the coming months. This, I think, was a very positive step forward. And at the same time, you may be aware that under the auspices of the OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, based in Paris, that the recipient countries similarly have been working on a code of investment rules for sovereign wealth funds. Let's put it this way. It's dramatically in everybody's interest that the implied capital flows that have resulted from the current imbalances of the past few years be managed in an effective, efficient, and globally responsible way. And that it is in the interest dramatically of the sovereign wealth funds and their host countries and the recipient countries as well. And it's very gratifying that there has been such rapid progress that represented or underpinned by this mutual insight of a need for clear understandings and a sense of openness and fairness. And so we are very hopeful that this inevitable process of the move from the growth of historically unprecedented international reserves be moved into a form of international investment that will have a long-term focus, will have a commercial underpinning and commercial goals, that will be operated in professional way, that on the other hand will have fair access to markets. Everyone stands to benefit from this process. So I've been personally gratified by the progress made so far and would be very displeased, very disappointed if this progress was disrupted.
I've promised.
Can I ask one favor?
Yeah, sure.
There's a young lady over there. I'd love to hear her question.
Sure.
It's Nancy Jacklin.
Johns Hopkins SAIS. Looking at where we've come and looking at some of the prior crises, I wonder what the fund's current thinking is when there seems to be widespread underpricing of risk in broad categories of assets, whether that is a signal that should cause some reaction either by central banks or regulators or other policy officials, if not obviously by the mispricers of the risk themselves who somehow don't see it.
Correct. Thank you. A very good question, of course. And what we have advocated, what we at the IMF have advocated, is a need. Some have said, for example, that the central bank needs to lean against the wind on mispricing of assets. That's a difficult course because it basically says that the central bankers know what things are worth and private markets investors don't, and therefore but it leads to very uncertain policy results. Not that it one of the things you learn in life is never say never. There may be circumstances that might be desirable. But the IMF has suggested that one of the lessons to be learned from the recent turmoil and the apparent uncertainty about pricing of risk is a need for a macroprudential approach or a through-the-cycle approach for financial regulation that that would be more supple than the so-called risk-based approach that has dominated over the past past few years, or let's call it cyclically insensitive approach. We think that's probably more more productive. We've had, as I've said earlier, a whole series of very specific regulatory recommendations that we are helping, that we help develop with the Financial Stability Forum, and we are helping to get implemented. But it's, as I said, this is going to require the first things first: stop the turmoil, stabilize the markets, and restore economic growth and restore full employment. But there will be then we need to do some serious thinking about what went wrong and why did, as I tried to indicate, why did market discipline fail so spectacularly in areas where it should have succeeded. At the same time, I was asked by someone today, isn't this just like the tech bubble? And I said, I thought the analogy was actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. The tech bubble, at the time people said, how could folks have been so silly? How could they have been so misguided? How could they have been so stupid? But we take a look back and say, has technology made an important difference in the in individual economies and in the world economy? Has the development of new technologies changed your own life? The answer is absolutely. Has it had an important impact on the structure of economies and their overall performance? The answer is absolutely. Has it been a force for good? The answer, I think, is absolutely. So you wouldn't want to miss the big picture. And here again, you wouldn't. It's too easy to say how silly all this was. I think you need to take a bigger picture, and hopefully that what we'll find out, as I said earlier, not all innovations get tested, not all innovations pass the test. But what I'm hopeful is that when, as we move forward and as we look back on this period, we'll find that many of the innovations will have been very productive, and that we'll understand why those failed, and we'll understand what we need to do to prevent this kind of problem again, and to make sure that financial markets do what they're supposed to do, which is to effectively allocate resources around the world economy to maximize growth and well-being. Thank you.
An excellent upbeat note to end on. Thank you very much. Please join me again in thanking John Lipsky.